Blog Talk Radio.
Paperback Writer.
This is the Writer's Lounge show where we showcase new authors. This is show number 137. It is May 1st, 2023, and I am your host, Tom Riddell, and co-host Terry Brown will be with us shortly. And on today's show, we have Roger Anderson, who wrote The Immigrant's Journey, and Roger will be right along with us at about 15 minutes after the hour, so stay tuned for that. And more about us, here's where you can find us out there. Find us on Facebook, The Writer's Lounge, showcasing new authors. Find the book reviews of all their current shows over at thomasridell.net. That's thomasridell.net. In the blog section, and the on-demand radio shows can be found there on the podcast page as well. Or go over to the Blog Talk Radio site and search for The Writer's Lounge, or find us easily on a Google search. Find me on Twitter at TomRidell56, and our email is writerslounge2020@yahoo.com. If you want to be a guest on the show and have your book reviewed, put guest request in the subject line and we will get back to you. Special note, we can now also be heard on your Alexa device. Subscribe to Apple Podcasts and ask her to play The Writer's Lounge showcasing new authors. I'd also like to put in a plug for Goodreads and Reads eDiscovery. They both do a great deal to help authors and readers alike, and I also review books on both sites as well. And upcoming authors on The Writer's Lounge on May 15, 2023, author Suzette Lytle will be here with her book Desert Phoenix. At once a sweeping love story and a harrowing account of the harshness of the American Old West, Desert Phoenix is the tale of a prostitute who gains an unlikely ally in her struggle for physical and emotional survival. This novel is based on family stories passed down from the author's grandfather. We look forward to learning more about this author and her book. And on May 29th, 2023, that's still open, so that will be announced at a later date. And now let's get on to the next segment of the show, which would be Writer's Topics. And this is where I introduce my wonderful co-host, Terry Brown, and we'll bring her right in here right now, and hopefully there she is. You there, Terry?
I sure am. How are you doing tonight, Tom?
Doing real well. It seems like we haven't talked in forever, and I suppose you're still keeping busy, and we're moving into the summer months here, so that's got to be a pleasure for you.
Oh, it is. I'm definitely a spring and summer kind of person, so it's nice to be able to get out to the beach and enjoy things and have a little bit of sunshine, and yeah, definitely good for me.
Yes, you do a lot of those beach walks, I see. I pay attention to you every day and watch
yep.
you walk along the beach, and I sit back up here in central New York and wish I could be there. But,
yeah, I remember you telling me that the sand is mine, but the ocean is yours.
Yes, exactly. So you
yes.
can have the sand,
yes.
but if you're going to step into the ocean, you have to get my permission to do that.
Well, I hope you understand. I step in it every day.
Oh, I suppose that, you know, you can. Let's just say if you go over your knees, and then you've got to. You've got to call me and let me know about it. But you can dip a toe.
I'll be sure to do that.
right. So that's great. I'm really glad to hear it. I'm glad that we're getting around to the nice weather, and it's always a pleasure to welcome spring. And today's subject, Terry, as I had indicated that I wanted to talk to you about, is about book banning and censorship, which is a hot topic these days. As in most everything in life today, it's almost impossible to avoid politics in our discussions about important issues that sometimes rise up and slap us in the face. Well, without diving too far into the politics side of this discussion, I feel like I have been slapped in the face, and I think most authors would agree we've been slapped. So, Terry, I was reading an understanding about this subject that, according to the American Library Association, last year, well over 1,300 books were put on the challenged list. And that's where
right.
people come forward to indicate whether or not they believe a book should be banned. And of those, close to 700 books were banned, some of them being, believe it or not, Harry Potter, which is the most successful and best-selling book in history, according to what I read today, and also Huckleberry Finn also was,
right.
well, pretty much censored for using the N-word. With Harry Potter, it was because of the witchcraft, And I also understand that 85% of Americans say no to book bans. So I was just wondering what your take on all this is, and affects us all.
Yeah, I think I want people to understand that a book can get on that book banned list if any library in the United States bans it. So it could be banned simply because one school system decides they don't want it in their school system. So that's one thing to keep in mind, is that just because a book was banned doesn't mean that it was banned across the United States. Now, I'm not
right.
saying that it's right that it was banned at all, but I do want people to understand that a book that is banned can get that label for being, you know, not allowed in one school system in the middle of you know, nowhere.
Right.
And then it can be on the list. Here's what I believe about book banning. I believe that as a parent, I have the right to determine whether my child reads a book, but that
Absolutely.
I do not have the right to tell any other parent or to tell any other child what they can read. So, you know, I think that as families, we definitely can say, I would prefer that my child not read, and then you can name whatever book that is. But in terms of putting it on a list so that other children cannot read it and other families cannot read it, I think that's when we go too far.
Right. And I think
I
totally agree with you. I think It all has to come back to the parenting of the kids, no matter what it is today. Whether it's, used to go to the movies, now we get the PG rating, and we would sneak in anyway. I mean, I can't think of anybody
right.
in my age group, now that I'm a very old man, getting there anyways, but we're all in that age group where we can remember times when we were children and when we were told not to do something, what did we do?
That's the first thing you did. I mean, if there was a book you weren't supposed to read, everyone went and read it. I mean, it was the first thing that you did. I went to a book club the other day, and the whole topic was on banned books. And every person in the book club read a banned book and then talked about why it was banned and what they found to be, you know, either good or bad. Some of the books blew my mind that have been banned. Hop on Pop.
Yes.
Hop on Pop.
Because it
talks about violence toward parents.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Crazy. Harriet the Spy. I can't remember why that one was done, but Harriet the Spy, that just blows my mind. Let's see. What was another one? Catcher in the Rye, To Kill a Mockingbird. Some of the books that we've all known. And then others that maybe we don't know as much. But Where the Wild Things Are by Maurice Sendak.
Right.
Because it's violent.
Right.
And it just blows my mind what some people are stating that other people shouldn't read. And as an author, that bothers me. That bothers me a lot.
Right.
Because if
right.
they're not allowed to read it, then they're telling me that I'm not allowed to write it.
I come from a time that when we heard of book banning and book burning, the other topic of this whole thing would be the book burning, which goes even
right.
further. They pile books on a heap and then they burn them. But it doesn't even sound American to me. It sounds horrible. I know with Rushdie there, what was the book that he was they went after him. They wanted to kill him because
yeah.
of the book that he wrote. And, we're on this slippery slope, and there's an easy solution to this, and we just mentioned it. It's the parents who have to get involved in a child's life. Yes, if a school gives something to a child for an assignment to read, the parent should be aware of what their assignment is. And then the parent should interject if they feel that it's inappropriate. But at the same time, you talk to your child about it.
If it's inappropriate, but if it's inappropriate for their child, they shouldn't then be able
right.
to say it's inappropriate for everyone else's child as well. And I think that's where the book banning comes in. Bothers me so much. It isn't that people make choices. I make choices every day about books. I go and I'll look at a book, and there's certain books that I will not read because I would not enjoy them. I know that. I know
right.
that I'm not going to enjoy books with certain things in them, so I won't read them. And so essentially I've banned it for myself, but I would never think to go tell my neighbor that because I would not appreciate this book that they would not and
yeah,
that they
and
cannot.
Absolutely. And the one book that I loved growing up, Huckleberry Finn, we mentioned it.
Right.
The use of the N-word, which is a horrible word to use, but at the same time, this is a word that was used a lot during those times. And Mark Twain, I would argue, is not a racist.
It was a word of the time. And it's
right.
no longer a word we use, but what a wonderful way to have that discussion.
Yeah, yes, absolutely. You sit down and you talk to your child and explain, You know, why would you throw the baby out with the bathwater? Everything in that book
exactly.
is amazing. It's about adventure. It's about imagination. So we could go on and talk about a lot of this stuff. And we are going to have to move on to the next segment of our show. And that, of course, is the guest author intro and interview. And today we have Roger Anderson on the show. And he once again wrote The Immigrant's Journey. And if you'd like to call in, if you're sitting out there with nothing to do but to listen to our show and listen to Roger talk to us about his book, you can give us a call at area code 914-219-0868. We'd love to hear from you. And don't be shy. We always tell everybody that. And still hardly nobody ever calls us, but I know that people are listening because I see the numbers after the show. So I do look and I do see that they are indeed listening. So my review of The Immigrant's Journey: Enoch Opsahl was born in 1890 in a small village near the southern tip of Norway. His family were poor potato farmers. They had lived there for many generations. Young Enoch, known to many as Knack-Knack, loved his home and family, but when he turned 16, his imaginations and aspirations turned to America. Many Norwegians were migrating there by ship, and Enoch was soon ready to follow. Broken in debt, his hardships were overwhelming, but he endured. The voyage was exciting, but the threat of disease and illness almost turned him back. After finally arriving in New York, Enoch looks for work and eventually finds work in Connecticut, working on a tobacco farm, stoking coal on a ferry, driving a taxi, and working in a stone quarry. The work is hard and difficult, but he is soon able to find his true calling, and that is to build railroads out west and to help string electric lines to a young and growing nation. While in the process of doing all this, he reunites with a young Norwegian girl. They marry and start a family. Enoch's love of Norway never wavers, and his love of America remains strong as he builds a future for him and his family. Based on true events, this work of historical fiction hooked me from the beginning, from the wonders and excitements of youth to the wisdom and realities of old age. I felt I was a part of Enoch's incredible journey through a difficult, amazing, and bountiful life. The author captures the essence and struggles of what it means to be an American born exclusively from immigrants who saw the greatness of what America could be and never looked back. The richness of his words speaks directly to our emotions, and I found that once I got started, I couldn't stop turning the page. Another unique treasure of the story were the many photos that were inserted along the way. I am quite sure that Enoch would be very proud of his grandson, Roger Anderson, and the story that he has told here. The Immigrant's Journey is a must read. And now it is our pleasure to welcome Roger Anderson to the Writer's Lounge broadcast. And through the magic of the Writer's Lounge, we were click on the button to open the door and bring him into the studio. And Roger, are you there?
I am, Tom. Hi, Terry. It's good to be with. Oh. It's good to be with you.
Very good to have you. And I found something very interesting. Something very interesting, Terry, is that Roger, I think he was kind of going after our hearts here because I'm not sure if it's true or not. We'll have to find out if it is. But I believe that Roger, during the winter months, spends his life in North Carolina. And then in summer, he goes to my second home, which is in Minnesota. Is that true, Roger, or are you telling a fib?
No, that's true. In fact, I'm heading back. My wife headed back a week ago. She was anxious to get back with the children and grandchildren. And I'm going to be driving up Friday. I'll be leaving Friday and heading up, be back this weekend to Minnesota.
Oh. So you're down in Terry's country.
North Carolina.
Yeah, so I'm in North Carolina. Where are you at, Roger?
St. James Plantation is the Oak Island.
You are kidding me.
No.
I live in Brookwood Plantation on the other end of the county.
Oh yeah, yeah, and I used to. Oh yeah, I used to live for 6 years. I had a home in Ocean Ridge, Plantation.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, sure. I played golf over at Brunswick, and oh sure, I know that area so well.
Yeah. So Roger and I live in the same county.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Is that crazy or what?
That's
we do.
Crazy.
Sunset Beach is one of the most beautiful to walk on the sand.
I agree. I go there probably 4 or 5 times a week.
Oh, wow.
Wow. See, Terry, I did it again. I brought you and made you another friend.
You make me friends all the time. Thank you.
Yeah, and the last show, the author was from my neck of the woods, not even 2 miles away. So, you know, it's amazing how things like that work out. But, Roger, let's get on to talking about you. Like your grandfather before you, you've had an interesting life up to this point. Could you tell us a little bit about your life and what got you interested in becoming a writer?
I'm not sure what got me interested in becoming a writer. It's kind of odd because first of all, I grew up in New Jersey, but my work life, I worked for PepsiCo for 15 years, mostly in finance. I have an MBA in finance. So that's that side of the brain, I suppose, and finance and general management. And then after I left Pepsi, I led a number of turnarounds, companies that were bankrupt. Are just about bankrupt, companies like Tonka, Kenner, Parker, Rollerblade, and Young America Corporation, which was a rebate fulfillment company. But I've always liked to write a lot, and I made my first effort at it about 15 years ago with a book called The Executive Calling. It was right after I retired, and I was retired for the first time. I went back for a few years afterwards. But I was reflecting on my career and with what I did in doing turnarounds for venture capital firms. I was put in positions a number of times of being asked to do things that I felt were either immoral or even illegal. And so I went through about 4 of those episodes So I wanted to write about that. I'm a Christian, and in each of those cases, I did what I thought I was right, and I think I was blessed because of it. So that was a book for Christian people in the business world. Basically, the message that you can do the right thing, you can be ethical, and still be successful in your business career. That got me started. And I had about 3 false attempts after that to write follow-up books. None of them ever got off the ground until I got the idea to do this book, The Immigrant's Journey.
And, of course, that was very personal to you because it's about your grandfather, and that was probably the driving force in getting the book done. I think Terry and I can both relate to that, and myself, I can relate since I had a grandfather who was the subject of my book that I wrote, and it's really, really interesting when that happens, and it kind of pushes you along a little bit more than it normally would, I think. But much of the first few chapters of your book takes us through a few villages and homesteads of Norway. Have you ever been there, and could you describe why your grandfather loved it so much?
Well, both sides of my family are Norwegian, so I kind of grew up steeped in all of the Norwegian customs and foods and everything else. I only made one trip back to Norway, and that was late in my years in college. I did a rail pass, and I studied at the University of Leiden International Economics for the summer, and then jumped on a railroad and met my parents back in. So that's on the other side of the family from what I write about in this book. I met them in my father's hometown of Risør, which is more on the east coast of Norway, north and east of the town I write about. Saw that homestead. Interesting, one day we were in Risør, and my father, he hadn't been back since he was, I think, about 10 or 11 years old to Norway, and we're walking around, and he's remembering things. We walk down to the shore, and there's a sawmill there. My father walked ahead and started talking in Norwegian, and before I know it, they're embracing. And it turns out that this was my father's best friend from when he was 10 years old. Now it's 50 years later.
Amazing.
But then we did get, it was a very cool moment. We did get up in the, get in the car, and we drove up over the mountains and hills to the town of Opsal, which is named after my grandfather. And so I saw the farmstead and the countryside. But that was the only time. I've got a lot of cousins that go back every year. They send me pictures, letters, and everything. So I kind of got an image of it and good visualization of what the whole area was like.
And, of course, you probably flew there. You didn't do what your grandfather did and took a ship. Is that correct?
Well, I flew to Holland, and then I took a train up to Norway. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, that's perfect. Perfect way to see the countryside. But Enoch, in your book, embarks on his passage to America in 1907, and he boards the ship, as we just mentioned, that will take him to his new home. What I found interesting, and I know immigration is a hot topic today, but I was very interested to learn of what you must have in order to, before you're entering America back in 1907. And there's a couple of things that you wrote in your book, what was required of people who were coming into this country, which absolutely floored me. And here's some of them that I've written down here. People under 16 would not be admitted unless accompanied by an adult. That's understandable. The next one would be idiots, mentally or physically weak people were not to be allowed in. And the next one was people who were expected to fall into poverty were to be denied. Criminals, people of moral depravity, harlots and pimps were not welcome. And applicants should have $30 or at least enough to sustain themselves for a period of time until they could find gainful employment. I was especially struck by how in the world would people decide if a person was an idiot, for example. Were you surprised when you learned of these requirements?
Yeah, that was kind of fun. It took me about 7 months to do a first draft of the book, and then another 6-7 months for proofreading and all the formatting and design and all that. But I would say that 7 months, more than half of it was research. And I found that part to be so enjoyable. I found different versions of how you came to Ellis Island. And I had to kind of pick out, the way that happened. And I think it must have happened a couple different ways. But, the $30, I found that was kind of flexible. I mean, if they liked you, you might get in with 15.
If you didn't happen to be an idiot, right?
If you didn't happen to be an idiot. Yeah, and they would – I don't know how they determined if you were an idiot.
I think in your book he counts to 10 and they let him in.
Yeah, I think he counted to 10 in both English and Norwegian. And, as I wrote in the book, he and his friends that he met on the boat were studying English during that whole trip. And I guess they made a little bit of progress. But,
Terry, you got a question for Rob?
So you were talking about, you know, doing research and how much you enjoyed it, which is really cool. I write a lot of historical fiction, and I also love doing research. In fact, I tell everybody that I'm a research junkie. In addition to finding out, you know, like the aspects of how to get into the country, was there anything else that, when writing The Immigrant's Journey, that really struck you as something, like, cool that you didn't know before you got started?
Well, I started out with a framework of letters and some documents from my aunts and uncles. And so I was able to piece together a timeline as to where Enoch was on in any given year and what he was doing. So, you know, so then it was a matter of going in and, you know, so for instance, when he got into C.R. Hedden, his first construction job, he was working to build a wharf, you know, so that was probably 2 or 3 days of research, like, you know, back in 1906 or 1909, when that was, how did they drive piles into the, you know, into
right.
the river and, you know, with steam engines and that type of thing. So there's probably 50 or 100 things that like that I had to research in terms of how did they do construction at that time, transportation, the roads. You know, he was living in New Jersey. What roads were there at that time?
Right.
And, yeah, and that was fun. There's just a wealth of information online that you can find about this stuff. It's incredible.
It is incredible. I think that you must have a very similar feeling that I do. When I'm writing historical fiction, my character is allowed to you know, have their own experiences, but they have to do them within a real framework, what really could have happened at that time. So I'm really picky about, you know, even what products were available and what they could have seen in an advertisement or anything, because I want it to feel as realistic as possible for that time.
Yeah, and one thing I'm pretty proud of is I'm not sure there's anything in there that's historically inaccurate. I think I had one paragraph where he bought a pair of Oshkosh jeans. Well, I had to go back and say, you know, when were they first sold, and to make sure that they were available back then. So that,
I did the same thing where I had one of my characters was putting Brill Cream in their hair, and then I stopped and I thought, well, I know it was big in World War II, but was it around before World War II? And, yep, it had come out in enough time that my 1939 guy could put it in his hair. But, yeah, I understand that. It's kind of fun. It's kind of fun when you go back and have to make those decisions, like, you know, can I include that or not?
Yeah. And I think, you know, even though I had a career in finance, I was always a history buff, you know, American history and all of that. So, you know, it was just kind of a fun school thing for me.
Yeah. The thing that I love about, I love about American history, when people talk about, you know, this great country that we live in, people always say, well, people died for this country. And I think a lot of people tend to think about the soldiers that died in war and fought in the wars. Of course, that's true. But I think a lot of the people that, you know, that went through the sweat and the injuries and the struggles like your grandfather did to do all that he did, on helping to build the railroads and all the construction, you know, that they did to build up this great country. It's on the backs of those people that I think of even more than the soldiers, because they really did build this country up, and it's amazing to me. And your story does a fabulous job of reflecting all of that. And that's why I think it's very important for people to read, you know, it's kind of a plug for Terry and I too, but reading historical fiction is so very important. I wish more people would do that and, you know, steer into that genre of story. But what I'm wondering, sir, is I'm wondering, what memories do you have of your grandfather and what most impressed you about him?
Well, as I mentioned at the end of the book, he died on July 2, 1963, the day of my birthday. I was sitting in the backyard, picnic table, having a birthday party. My mom came out crying. So I was only 10 when he died. But most of the memories I have, the early memories, as I describe in the book, when he finally retired and he had this yearning for Norway, he found 106 acres in northwest New Jersey that was very similar to his home in his original home in Norway. Same kind of rocky shale, bad soil. And he bought this farm. He built a little red house up on the hill, which he called Spruce Hill, because he planted 200 Norwegian spruce up on the hillside, also to remind him of Norway. But then he leased out the 106 acres to a dairy farmer. But anyway, Enoch had four daughters, and I think I had 13 cousins, and we would all go up there on weekends for picnics and run around the woods, shoot target shoot rifles, help to milk the cows, and all of that. And just so many vivid family memories. And the book really got started it was about 3-4 years ago that I got curious and I did some research and I found the name of the owner who owns the same farm today, called he and his wife up and introduced myself and was able to get an invitation to organize a reunion of the surviving cousins. And we had to delay it for, I think, 2 years because of COVID. But we finally did it 2 years ago in a little more than 2 years ago, and I think it was in May. I think it was in the spring, and the cousins came from Alaska, Texas, Maine, New Hampshire, Minnesota, Virginia, all over, and we all met there for a day, and the current owner gave us a nice tour, and it was so much the way we remembered. And by the end of the day, I said, you know, I have to write this story. And that's when I went home and started to write.
Ah, yes. Yes. What a great thing. Terry?
Yeah, so do you have any other writing projects underway that you can tell us about?
I've got three. One I'll mention briefly. It's actually something I wrote about 8 years ago. I used to be a very avid upland bird hunter, and I had great pointing dogs and friends with pointing dogs. We just hunted a lot, pheasants mostly, Minnesota, Iowa, South Dakota, North Dakota. And what happened was I was hunting so much, and the dogs were so good that I was bringing home so many birds, and the kids didn't like eating them. And one day my wife dragged me to the freezer, opened it up, and said, you got to stop hunting. She said, I have no room for anything in here but your pheasants. And so I thought, well, I'm not going to stop hunting. I need a better solution. So I started to think, you know, the recipes that people had given me just weren't, it was dry, it wasn't very good. I thought about, you know, if you remember our youth, you used to go to the grocery store and they had something called a stewing chicken. And that was the old bird, not the young Purdue that's, you know, 16 weeks old. And you'd throw it in a pot. And so I started out with American colonial recipes. How did they cook that barnyard chicken? And, found about five recipes, and then I broadened it to third world countries from Africa to Asia, some of Europe, although it's not third world, but old recipes for stewing chickens, and they were just wonderful. We cleaned out our freezer, and back then I just printed the recipe book off on Kinko's, and took it to hunting clubs. They loved it, and they bought everything that I printed. So I'm now having that professionally published and formatted. So that's just a little fun project. The big project is a companion book for The Immigrant's Journey about the other side of my family. It's going to be called The Immigrant's Clan. And it really features my grandmother on my father's side, who also came over 1910 or something like that, alone by herself as a young girl, and went to Manhattan and became a maid. And then she met a guy who's Gottwald or George. Her name was Helene. And this has got a different tone to it, this book, because he became an alcoholic and abusive. And she ended up having 8 children. And eventually during the Great Depression, it got so bad that my father and a couple of the brothers physically tossed him out of the house onto the street in Brooklyn, and that was the last time anyone saw him. But it's called The Immigrant's Clan because they all dropped out of school, did what work they could to pull together and get through the Great Depression, supported their mother, and supported each other for the next 40 years, 50 years. And it was a good success story. And, it's a story about family going through hard times and pulling together and helping each other. So that's the big project.
Awesome.
Thank you. I got another one. It's going to be called The Child Within. When I was young, I felt like my mother was old. But as I got older, I more and more I saw the little girl inside her. She could do silly things, giggly, and even in her last days when she was sick, she would laugh and tell silly stories. Other people have had the same experience. I first dated my wife when I was 15, so it's a lot of years later. But I still see that little young girl in her sometimes, and brings out a youthfulness in me as well. So I'm going to look for people who have similar experiences and probably get 20 people or so to write a chapter about their own experience with their elder parent of the child within them.
Right, right. And I can tell you that I haven't even grown up yet. I'm living in a 67-year-old body. But I have a mind of probably a 10, 15-year-old kid still. So I'm still the kid. And I just love that whole idea, Roger. And I really look forward to reading that. Maybe I'll come up with something to contribute. But it's true, as we get older, looking at it from a perspective of a young child, as I looked at my grandparents, they're the ones who adopted me when I was raised. But I would look at them and see 60, 65, 70-year-old people. And to me, they were ancient. And I could never imagine that they were ever children. But now that I'm their age, I live it. I live it every day. My body doesn't always, stand up to those kind of memories, but I do live it, so I can really appreciate what you're doing. And you are keeping very busy for a retired gentleman. You're much like myself, and I know Terry could probably relate to that too. But we keep ourselves busy, and I think that's important in life to keep young too, to keep busy doing our research, learning new things, and it's so much fun being a writer today and to be able to do the things that we do, especially with writing the book that you did. But I have a question that comes up almost all the time here on the Writer's Lounge, and that would be, how do you handle the good and not so good reviews?
That's a good question. I guess I ignore the bad ones because I've been pretty lucky or pretty blessed. Between Goodreads and Amazon, I've had like 100 reviews with a 4.8 star rating. So almost all of them were fives. Some were fours. I got one too, and I think I know who it is. But but the good reviews, I mean, one of the real wonderful fulfilling things about writing is when you read someone, as you did, write something and you said you couldn't stop turning the pages, or some other people have said, I couldn't put it down. You know, I just go to bed feeling wonderful when I read one of those.
Yeah, and Terry
that's the way I
been,
feel. Oh, yeah. Like I get a review like that, and I just feel like I'm floating.
Yes, we have to pull her down to the ground.
You know, if there's more of a mediocre review, if most of them were threes, I would just doubt whether the book was very good, but that's not been the case at all. But, you know, when I do get more of a mediocre review, I just kind of shrug and I say, you know, it probably wasn't that person's genre.
Right.
And I think that's it.
Yeah.
One of the things that I've decided about reviews that are significantly different from what other people are saying makes me believe that whoever chose the book didn't choose very well for themselves. It isn't my book per se. It's that they didn't make a good choice for the type of book that they prefer to read. Now, like you said, if everyone were saying it, that's a different story. But when it's just those few here and there, I just figure it's a them issue, not a me issue. So.
Yes.
Right.
Terry, you got the next question.
Yeah. So, you know, kind of along the same lines, what defines success for you as a writer?
Well, not financial. you know as well as I do, you know, I hired a story editor. I hired a proofreader, someone, studio that did the formatting, the layout, and the cover design. So you probably have an idea what that costs. I'm told, you know, my book's had over 500 in sales in 4 months, which I'm told for a first-time author is really quite good. And it's
phenomenal.
Up.
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, this last month has been the best ever. Thanks to some tips I found on Facebook. It's just the process of writing. I mean, I usually write in the evening, late at night. I get very much into it. I think what I'm writing is Hemingway or brilliant, and I get up in the morning and it's terrible. And then I rewrite it the chapter two or three times until my wife says it's okay. And I love the process when I can get into it. But everyone talks about writer's block. I'll get a writer's block for 2 weeks, and then all of a sudden I'll have, you know, a couple days where I'm very productive.
Right.
I'm not blessed with a spouse, but when I write, I let my cat look at it, and if she says it's okay, then I go ahead.
Then you go on. Oh, that's good.
Yes,
that's good.
My cat yeah. makes the decision. So, besides writing, Roger, what do you like to do?
I play a lot of golf. I play three or four times a week. which is why, even though my wife went back north, I'm still here because Minnesota needs another week or two before it's good golf weather. I fish. I like to go for walks in the woods. My wife walks on the beach. I go up trails in the woods and stay in touch with family, with my children, grandchildren. It's a pretty full life.
Great. Where in Minnesota do you live when you live there?
It's a town called Excelsior. It's on Lake Minnetonka.
Yes.
It's about a half hour. Yeah, it's about a half hour west of Minneapolis.
Yeah, that's where my brother lives, and I was out there for Christmas, and I lived over in Maplewood, over on the eastern side of the Twin Cities. So maybe if I get there in another year, I think I'm going to go out there for my brother's wedding. Maybe I can look you up if he gets married in the summer, that is. So.
I'd like that. That'd be great.
It would be great.
And, and you're also welcome to contribute a chapter to The Child Within.
Yes, I absolutely will. And I hope that Terry will, too, because there's certainly a child in her.
Well, you know, that was when you were talking about that. I kept thinking, my mom was 20 years old when she had me. And so when I'm 10, she's 30. And I remember she was old. My mother was old. And then when I was, in my mind, you know what I mean? Then when I was 30, I thought, oh my gosh, I don't know anything. I'm still, I thought my mother was the wisest, oldest person there was. And at 30, I thought, oh my gosh, was I crazy? You know, and now, you know, so I'll be 60 this year. My mom's 80. And she doesn't seem old to me anymore. So here she is 50 years older than she was then. Then she was old, and now she doesn't seem old at all because I think I see myself getting to 80 very quickly.
I think that's the experience in a lot of us. You know, as Tom said, you know, our bodies are aging, but, you know, we still feel like the same person we were. Now, you might have had the same experience. You ever get together with a couple old college buddies? When I do that, when I first see them, I go, oh my gosh, you know, you've aged. But within half hour and maybe an adult beverage, I feel like I'm 21 again, and they sound like just like they were 21. So, you know, that youth is always within us.
I just went to a high school reunion, and it was our 40th.
Yeah.
And by the time the weekend was over, I was 18.
Yes.
And it was crazy because I felt 18. And I'm not 18. You know, there's a long time between me and 18.
Yeah.
And it just... Yeah, it's like we were all kids again.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's a good feeling.
It is crazy. Yeah, it is. It's a great feeling, but it is kind of crazy how that happens. Yeah, I tell people all the time. My son will be 33 this month, and I tell everyone that that's really hard to believe, given that I'm 34. That, you know, how the math is just not working anymore.
Right. Yeah, the years really slip past when you sit down with somebody. I think the initial shock is you're looking at that person going, oh, my God, they look like they're 150. And then, you know, a few minutes into the conversation, you're right back there again. All of a sudden that 150-year-old is the 21-year-old that you remember, you know, hanging out with and everything. So it's amazing when that happens, and it's, you know, it's all part of our life. But anyway, Roger, we're getting close to the end here, and this is what we call here on the Writer's Lounge. This is your Oscar moment. Any parting words of advice or anyone you would like to thank for your success you've had with the book or in life?
Well, thank you very much for the time. I've really enjoyed it, and I'm surprised how quickly it's gone by. I think The primary person I'd like to thank is my wife. She was a good proofreader, and a couple cousins and some friends all helped with the initial proofreading. And it's amazing how that helps. So they contributed a lot, and I really appreciate them for that.
Yep, and of course, your grandfather, who is, I'm sure, looking down upon you right now, you'd have to give him a lot of thanks, too, for, you know, inspiring you to write what you did. An amazing life that he lived, and an amazing life that you're living, and it's been great to have you on the show. Where can listeners contact you?
Well, let's see, I'm on Amazon and Goodreads. They can send me messages through, if they go look up my book, there's a link there. They can send me messages. I've got a few kind of trick questions for them. If they read the book, they have to try to guess a couple things. So that would be great.
That's good. Great. Roger, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for being on the Writer's Lounge, and we'll be looking forward to reading what comes out of your mind next.
Okay. Tom, Terry, thank you so much.
Yep. Thank you.
Thank you, Roger. So there we go. Terry, make sure again that I don't hang up on the wrong person here. what did you think? I thought it went really well, and it was really, really fun to talk with Roger. And it's good, I guess, the takeaway from this is that, you know, we may be getting older, but we still have a lot in us that we can produce a lot. And our creative juices are still flowing even when we get to be up, you know, and into the – I'm much older than you are, but, you know, I'm still creative and everything, or at least I like to think so.
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting that I used to think that you'd get to, you know, this retirement age and then you were kind of done. And now I look at it as I'm just getting started. So,
yes.
No, it was a great conversation. It was wonderful to talk to Roger and hear how excited he was about doing the research. I love to talk with people who love to do research because I love it. I actually had interview with someone who told me, oh, I hate the research part. And I thought, I don't even understand you. I don't understand what you mean by that. How can you hate the research?
Yeah,
and
I hope they're not writing
historical
fiction.
No, they're not. She said, you should do that as a service to writers. And I'm thinking, why? Who wouldn't want to do their own research? Yeah. So.
Exactly. So anyway, on May 15th, the next time around in 2 weeks, author Suzette Lytle will be here with Desert Phoenix. It's a sweeping love story and a harrowing account of the harshness of the Old West. And so I hope that you will join us then. And until then, Terry and I will see you next time on the Writer's Lounge, where we encourage writers and readers to keep the pen and eyes to the page and to let the story begin. Enjoy yourselves and be well. And from Terry and Tom, good night.
If they asked me, I could write a book about the way you walk and whisper and look. Of the plot, it's just to tell you that I love you a lot. Then the world discovers, as my book ends, how to make